Everyone for being here, and we have a lot of our members who, of course, are out of town for the holidays, and that's one reason why we're especially happy for those of you who are visiting with us. Some are here for the very first time, and again, we thank you for being here. This morning in our lesson, we looked at reactions to the resurrection of Jesus, the reactions that various people had to reports about Jesus' resurrection, or reactions that people had to the evidence of Jesus' resurrection, the empty tomb or things like that. And we looked at three reactions, that of shock that most everybody had at first when the idea of Jesus being raised was first presented to them. A lot of people reacted with disbelief and some even a continual and angry kind of disbelief and opposition to Jesus. And then some reacting with doubt, sometimes even those who believed in Jesus and his own disciples, yet still the Bible teaching us that there was some degree of doubt that they would have in their minds about all this and all that now the resurrected Jesus was calling upon them to do. But I want to talk with you this evening about what I think is the most important reaction of all that people had and have had to the resurrection of Jesus. And that is something very wonderful, that of joy. Absolute, overwhelming, unmitigated joy at the fact that this Savior, who was thought to be dead, is now alive again. And especially I want to look at that tonight in reference to three people or groups of people. First of all, Mary Magdalene. I want you just to think for a little bit about this woman and her life in association with Jesus, and then her reaction when she realizes that Jesus really is alive. You know, Mary Magdalene is spoken about in Luke chapter 8 and verse 2. She is a woman from whom Jesus had cast seven demons or evil spirits, apparently referring to demons that possessed her and even perhaps gave some bodily affliction to her in the context. That seems to be what is talking about there. And later church tradition would, I think, unfortunately, associate Mary Magdalene with another woman the Gospels speak about. And so Mary Magdalene sort of had a reputation throughout the centuries as having been a prostitute. And that's still the way that a lot of people think about her. And the Bible doesn't say that about her. I think that is an unfortunate thing. However, I do think it is pretty clear from what the Gospels would indicate that this woman who had been possessed by seven demons and afflicted probably was not of a very high social class. I don't think she had been a prostitute, but nevertheless, not of a very high social class. And if indeed that is the case, you can kind of see that following into the pattern of what Jesus so often demonstrated, a mercy and a pity upon those who were maybe in the lower classes, maybe viewed as outside the normal range of society, and yet Jesus willingly teaching them the gospel, willingly accepting them. And so what you see is that Mary is one of a handful of women who really are among the band of disciples. You have Jesus' male disciples whom he's training to be his teachers and ambassadors. But then there are others, and among those men, disciples, you do have some women who are able to travel around with Jesus and constantly be hearing him as he teaches his disciples. And Luke tells us that they were using their own funds to contribute to this band of disciples, Jesus and his disciples, to support them so they could travel. And so Mary is certainly one of those women. And what you see in Mary Magdalene is a woman who is filled with such gratitude about what Jesus had done for her in her life that she's just devoted herself to him and to his ministry. And she is one of those, according to John 19 and verse 25, who was there at the cross, and she's watching her Lord and her Master be tortured to death on the cross. And she witnesses that. And that makes it so poignant when you come to John 20, and you look at verses 1 through 18, and Mary Magdalene is afforded a singular honor. She is the first person who sees the resurrected Lord. You might think, and maybe we might, if we were creating this story or this sequence of events, we might say, well, one of the apostles should have been the very first one. Maybe all the apostles should have seen the resurrected Lord together for the very first post-resurrection appearance. Or maybe if there was one person who would be singled out, it should have been maybe an apostle like Peter, and Jesus appearing first to Peter. But that's not what happened. That was not the plan here. And so what you see is that the very first person who witnesses the resurrected Lord, it's Mary Magdalene. And when you look at John 20, the opening verses, what you see there, and we alluded to this morning, when she and the other women first came to the tomb and they see that the stone has been rolled away and they look in that tomb and there's an angel. It's a young man, but later it's determined that this actually was an angel. And the angel says, "He's not here, he is risen." And Mary and the other women, well, they didn't believe that. They thought somebody must have stolen the body. The body obviously was gone, but they certainly didn't believe this idea of resurrection. I don't know what they were thinking, if this was just some young man who just was caught up in all this and had the outlandish idea that Jesus' body is not here because he's been and raised. Well, Mary and the other women, they don't buy that. And Mary, in John 20, she comes, she runs to where the apostles are, and she tells them, not that Jesus has been resurrected, but she tells them, somebody's taken his corpse. And she's upset about that, and she's distraught about that. And of course, Peter and John run to the tomb to see for themselves what has happened. And Mary follows them, but by the time she gets there, they themselves have already witnessed the empty tomb and they have left. And so Mary has come there, has come back to the tomb. And in a very poignant and picturesque depiction of these events, John tells us that Mary is weeping and she's sobbing. She's stooping down and looking inside the tomb. These little doorways of these tombs cut out of solid rock. And you can just imagine her stooping down and she's looking in. And this time she sees two young men in there. And they're telling her that he's not here. He's been resurrected, just like he told her. And again, she just dismisses that. She doesn't know who these strangers are, but she dismisses what they are saying. She knows he was dead. She was there and saw him crucified, saw him buried. And you can picture her, and she's stooping down, and she's looking in the tomb, and she notices that there's a stranger that's behind her. She assumes him to be the gardener, and so she's weeping, and she's crying, and the stranger behind her asks her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she's saying, "Because they've stolen the body of my Lord." And then she hears the stranger behind her say, "Mary." Can you imagine her joy? She turns around and she sees that this stranger is not a stranger at all. This stranger is her Lord and her Master, and the only thing that can come out of her mouth is just Rabboni, my Master. And she just grabs onto him, and he says, "Mary, stop clinging to me. I haven't yet ascended to my Father." I think he means by that, "Have to hold me here. I haven't yet ascended to heaven. I'm going to be here a little bit longer." But just imagine the joy of this one. And that's just a marvelous thing to contemplate. And the compassion that Jesus had upon this woman and how her life had changed as a result of his compassion upon her. And now she's the one who's given this honor of seeing Jesus alive again. The very first one to see the resurrected Lord. It's a very poignant picture. Perhaps an even more poignant picture of joy in reaction to Jesus' resurrection is by the mother of Jesus herself, Mary, the mother of Jesus. Acts chapter 1, verses 13 and 14 just has a little note there. Luke just adds a little note. You might skip over it if you're reading too quickly. talking about the disciples who were there on that occasion. Now 120, this is after Jesus has been resurrected and just prior to the day of Pentecost. And it talks there about the apostles are there, and a total of 120 disciples are there, and included among them, Mary, the mother of Jesus, as well as Jesus' brothers. And I think that's so wonderful. And just to imagine the joy that Mary, Jesus' mother, would have had at a moment like this, where she now recognizes that her son is alive again. You know, you think about Mary in the opening chapters of Luke's Gospel, Luke 1 and 2, and those marvelous discussions of the angel Gabriel coming to her and telling her that she is going to conceive a child in her state of virginity and miraculous conception, and that child will indeed be the Son of God. And this is such a singular honor given to this young woman, or maybe we should even think of her as just a young girl at the time, in all probability. And it is marvelous when you think about the fact that there are certain things that Mary, the mother of Jesus, this young girl, certain things she knew. She knew personally that other people had to take on faith. She knew she had been a virgin when she conceived that child. She knew that Jesus was a divine child. She knew she was there when the angel and saw the angel and heard the angel tell her what was going to happen. And she knew that she had not been with a man. And she knew the child that was growing in her womb for 9 months was a child put there by God Himself. And so in a very real sense, she knew Him to be this Messiah, this Son of God, with personal knowledge, not simply having to rely upon faith, but personal knowledge in a way that the other disciples of Jesus never could know. And yet, when you look at Luke chapter 2, verses 19 and following, what you see is that there are still things that Mary, the mother of Jesus, did not know and did not understand about this child to whom she had given birth. And she was as much in the dark as the rest of the disciples. In Luke chapter 2 and verse 19, you have Luke make the statement that as Mary is observing all these amazing things happen, where the angels are hailing him, this newborn child, and the shepherds are coming and honoring him, this newborn child. And the text says she just treasured these things up in her heart. And she observed Jesus as the events of his life unfolded. And more than once in Luke's gospel, we're told that she treasured these things up in her heart. But what was she thinking? She knew he was the Messiah. The angel told her that. He was the promised Messiah. But her idea of his Messiahship was the same as everybody else's. She assumed what that meant is that one day this child would grow up and would be another David, another militaristic warrior, and he would defeat the Romans, and he would reign upon an earthly throne. And so that was her vision of what his Messiahship and his kingship meant. And yet she has to just live in perplexity about the various things that happened to him, or even the various things that she witnessed. In Luke chapter 2, verses 34 and 35, when Jesus is just this young baby and she presents him before the Lord at the temple, as the law of Moses said that one was to do. And she presents him there, and Simeon, an old man, a prophet of God who's there at the temple, he takes that child from her arms and puts that child in his own arms, and he says that this child, yes, is going to be the one to redeem Israel, but he said there's going to be a sword that's going to pierce your very soul, Mary. And indeed, as she observed Jesus as a grown man in his ministry, you can just see that sword begin to pierce her soul. Because he's not the kind of king that she had anticipated him being. And he's not treated in the way that she had anticipated him being treated. He has a band of followers. That fluctuates from time to time, as some of them even stop following him. Her own sons, the other sons that she and Joseph had, they don't believe that their brother is the Messiah. And she has to live her years with that kind of tension in her family and her home life. And now the brothers of Jesus, once he begins his ministry, they're opposing him. They're mocking him. They're denouncing him and his claims. Mary knows his claims are the truth, but now she's got this issue she's having to deal with. She never anticipated that. But the sword that would pierce her soul will get even worse than that. Because as John 19, verses 26 and 27 teaches us, she had to be there and watch her son die. That's not what she anticipated. That's not what she expected. That's not how this was supposed to be. He's supposed to be the Messiah. He's supposed to be the answer to all of God's prophecies. He's supposed to be the Redeemer of Israel. And all of that seems to have failed, and she's watching him die. You know, I can't think of a more horrible thing than for a parent to have to deal with a child that dies. You know, children are supposed to bury their parents, not the other way around. But here's a woman who has to watch her son die. But it's not just, as horrible as that is, it's not just watching your own son die. It's watching your own son not pass away peacefully in his bed of affliction, but be tortured to death hanging on a cross. That's what she has to observe. And then beyond all that, it just seems like everything that her whole life had been based on has just been a fraud. Because he's supposed to be this Messiah. And I know he was miraculously conceived in my womb. I know he's the Son of God. I know that. And yet, he's being slain by these Romans. And so she has to watch all of that. And in that poignant moment, Jesus on the cross, he looks down upon his mother. And you can just imagine Jesus thinking about all of her thoughts and the perplexity and the emotional agony. And he knows that sword is piercing his mother's soul, even at that very moment. And Jesus hanging on the cross in the midst of his own torture sees Mary and sees John, his apostle and his good friend, closest friend of all the apostles. And he says, hanging from the cross, "Woman, behold your son." And he looks at John and says, "Son, behold your mother." And from that hour, John takes Mary into his own home and cares for her and provides for her. But that's what Mary was having to deal with. And just imagine all of that. Just imagine all of her faith in God and her faith and even what she herself had witnessed. It's all being challenged. And that's why I think it's such a wonderful thing that in Acts 1, verses 13 and 14, Luke just adds in the text. And among that group of 120, you know who else was there on that occasion? It's Mary, the mother of Jesus. And guess who's standing alongside her? Luke says, and Jesus' brothers. Because now they know it too. That yes, their older brother really was the Messiah, the Son of God, just as their mom had always been saying. And now that family is united again and spiritually is united in that common understanding and common faith that Jesus is the Son of God, all because he's been resurrected. Can you imagine the joy that she had at that moment? It's a wonderful thing. Reactions to Jesus' resurrection. I'll tell you a joyful reaction to Jesus' resurrection. His apostles. His apostles, once they come to understand that yes, he is the resurrected Son of God, what joy must have filled their hearts for a lot of reasons. The magnitude of their joy, it just must have been an amazing amount. In Matthew chapter 26, verses 33 through 35, you read there about Jesus and the Last Supper, and he's with his apostles, and he's talking again about the fact that he's going to be betrayed. He's going to be betrayed by one of his own, by even one of those sitting there at the table of all things. And of course, they all deny that, and they're all wondering, you know, who could he mean? And they're all, you know, I would never do that, Lord. In fact, that leads them to all start pronouncing how they would be there for you, Jesus. We will never betray you. We're always going to be there to protect you and to stand by you no matter what happens. And Peter is saying that. And, you know, Jesus looks at Peter and says, Peter, you're making that kind of bold statement before the night's over. Three times you're going to deny you even know me. And all of them were saying the same thing. It wasn't just Peter. And so they're all proclaiming loudly their great loyalty for Jesus. And yet what you see is that then later in the evening when the guards come up and Judas is in the front and Judas deceitfully kisses Jesus on the cheek, and the guards now know which one is Jesus. And so they arrest him, and now he's being taken away by the authorities. Now what's the reaction of those apostles? Well, Peter reacts for a moment. You know, he gets a sword, you know, and he takes at least one swipe to defend Jesus and manages to cut off Malchus's ear. I guess Malchus ducked. And Jesus tells him to put up a sword. Doesn't want this to turn into something ugly here. I'm very willing to go with him, Jesus is saying. And it's at that moment when Jesus is then put under bonds and then taken away that Jesus' apostles, every one of them who have professed such dedication and loyalty, every one of them then just scatters like sheep. Pretty short-lived loyalty. And Peter follows from a distance, and you know the stories in the courtyard of Caiaphas, and three times he says he doesn't even know who Jesus is. He's afraid. He doesn't want to be arrested along with Jesus. So he tries to watch from afar, but they keep recognizing him as one of those main apostles with Jesus. And so the third time he denies him, in the distance they hear a cock crow. In Luke chapter 22 and verse 61, in one of the most emotional statements, I think, in all of Scripture, says that Jesus, as he's in the midst of his trial, the cock crows for that time, and he looks toward Peter, and their eyes meet. And Peter knows, and he knows Jesus knows, that he'd said he'd stand by Jesus no matter what, no matter what they did. And when the moment came, Peter absolutely crumbled. And more than that, in his cowardice, in his lack of faith, in his betrayal of his master and his friend, he had cursed and sworn that he even knew who that man Jesus was. Talk about betrayal. Talk about letting someone down. And yet, look at what we read in Luke 24. In fact, let me read these verses, these final verses here in Luke's gospel. This is Luke's record of the very last of the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. Not the first one, where they're in still a state of shock and awe about all this and disbelief and some doubt thrown in. No, this is the very last of those post-resurrection appearances. And verse 50 says, and he led them out, Jesus led them out, as far as Bethany, and he lifted up his hands and blessed them. And it came about that while he was blessing them, he parted from them, and they returned to Jerusalem with great joy, and were continually in the temple praising God. I can't help but think that the tremendous amount of joy that Jesus' apostles felt was a joy that sprang from their own remembrance of how they had let him down, how they had betrayed him, how they had wronged him, how they had sinned against him. And yet, and here's the point, brethren, the resurrection of Jesus, it just made up for all of that. It made up for all of that. If they'd had to live the rest of their lives knowing that they were the ones who had fled when their friend and their master needed them the most, and he'd gotten slain and that was it, and they lived the rest of their lives with that kind of emotional scar upon them, how horrible would that have been? But 3 days after his crucifixion, he was alive again. And that just made up for everything. And folks, let me tell you this. All of us have betrayed Jesus. All of us have professed our dedication to him. Maybe on that moment when we were baptized, when we confessed his good name, maybe on that day, maybe on some later day, we professed our Christianity publicly to other people or privately to other people. And yet there are then later occasions when we were put in some position where we were called to defend Jesus, to stand up beside Jesus, or to live in accordance with his teaching, and we have scattered. We fled. Our faith went away. And we betrayed him. What the gospel of Jesus Christ is teaching us is that the resurrection of Jesus, amazingly, makes up for all of that. It makes everything right again. It's not that it's okay that we betrayed him. It isn't that. But what the gospel is saying is that the damage of our sin, his resurrection over. And that's really what the Bible is teaching us. We as human beings, so often in our lives, we have sinned. And yet, God, in his power and in his eternal purpose, it's this plan of just rectifying all the mistakes that we have made and making everything right again. And that's what Jesus' resurrection does. And it's a way of Jesus saying, I forgive you for all of that. In fact, this plan of my death and resurrection, it foresaw that you would do all of those things. And this is what makes up for all of those things. And I think what we're reading here in Luke chapter 24, this final post-resurrection appearance of Jesus, the disciples now, they understand that. And their own guilt has been assuaged by their knowledge of the fact that in his mercy God had sent Jesus and that Jesus was now alive again and everything was now made right. And so now they are looking at their mission as Jesus' disciples, spreading his message to the world as something that fills them with great joy and great honor to be able to be one of his people and to be his ambassador and to serve him and proclaim his name. And that same feeling of joy needs to fill our hearts. And there may be times when you look at your life and yes, you're filled with that great guilt about how you let Jesus down, but understand this, just like they came to understand it. The resurrection of Jesus, it just changes all that. It makes it all right now. Jesus has rectified everything, and it ought to fill us with joy and with an absolute dedication. Whatever Jesus wants me to do, I'm going to do that. And that's how these disciples of Jesus felt. So I wonder if there's someone tonight who needs to dedicate himself or herself to Jesus. All of your sins, no matter what they have been, Jesus' resurrection, his death and resurrection, atone for them, and makes everything right again. But you need to be one of his followers. And what great joy you can have tonight as you leave this building if your life is right with God. Is there someone who's been an erring disciple, and like some of the disciples we've talked about this evening, you've fallen away? Do you need to return? Why not do so tonight? Again, you can be filled with great joy and know that His death and resurrection has made up for all of your sins. If we can assist you, let us know, won't you, while together we stand and sing.